Good day, everybody. Welcome to another exciting and scintillating episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse Support. I'm here with my two buddies, Matt Kachansky, retired.
Freshly shorn.
Went over to the local farm.
Sheep shearing season.
Sheep shearing. Welcome. Welcome. It is. I mean, listen, you brought it on yourself. I wasn't going to say a word.
Smirking through the entire introduction.
That is true. Whatever. So I got Matt here, and of course I have Wade McFall, the serious one of the three. Thank God someone's here to be the adult in the room. Wade McFall, Assistant Special Agent Charge, retired from the LA office of the OIG and a director here on our investigative team. So I'll probably continue smiling the whole time, Matt, because I wouldn't have, but you brought this on yourself. So it's okay. So yeah. Absolutely. Put that. The funny thing is that your hair is so normally hefty and thick that when you put that hat on, you didn't adjust the size. It's like a kid putting on his dad's hat. It's all right. Listen, I can't judge too much. So it is what it is. So we want to talk about back to the business at hand, because that's the important stuff. So we want to talk. There was a press release that came out the other day involving a company named Zynex, Z-Y-N-E-X, a durable medical equipment device company, I guess DME device, and they manufactured and distributed TENS units for home use. And their big fraud scheme was excessive sale or transfer or mailing, whatever you want to call it, of electrodes and batteries to people who had the Zynex device. And, you know, I think The interesting part of this is there's two pieces. We'll talk a little bit about both pieces, but one piece is the chief operating officer and the CEO of the company were both criminally indicted for the fraud. The CEO was ordered to be remanded, which means he's being held in custody. And the chief operating officer was given a bond. And the company itself entered in what's called an NPA, non-prosecution agreement, where they agree to a bunch of things. They're currently in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection right now. And as part of that reorganization, they're paying a bunch of money and things of that sort. So, but the fraud is that there were an excessive amount of electrodes and batteries that were being provided to the Medicare population. And these were done on kind of an auto ship process where you theoretically people opted in. We don't know if that actually happened. Probably not, which is why it's excessive. But people opted into having the auto ship. And you see these kind of schemes with a lot of other things. You see them with diabetic testing supplies. We see it with adult diapers. We see it with anything that's on kind of an auto pay. And we were kind of joking beforehand. And Wade, I'll start with you, because I equated it to the company that has that very big website where you can buy almost anything. And they have some stuff they do on TV as well. And there's a guy with a big yacht that drives around that owns that company, which started off selling books. You know that company. And they have the subscribe and save. Right before you know it, you have 37 boxes of cat litter that you didn't need or 150 extra rolls of toilet paper. But the important takeaway is these schemes are easy to perpetuate because people get them and they say, well, I could always use the extra. And then before you know it, they've got an inordinate amount. So But data, the high volumes of things should give away that there might be a problem. And I think for me, the issue is, and we'll talk a little bit about a few things, I guess, but policy edits are an important piece of this. And had there been a policy edit in place, like the question almost begs itself, if the policy is you should get 6 electrodes a month and 2 batteries, how is it that 12 or 24 or whatever it is? But the other half of this, and this is the part where even if there are policy edits, if people don't need the electrodes or people don't need the batteries, if every month they're on a cadence of getting electrodes and batteries, right? It's like in the diabetic world, if you're supposed to test 3 times a day, but you only test 2 times a day, well, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, but at the end of a month, you're going to have 30, 40, maybe however many extra strips you're going to have. And so it's kind of the response. It's not kind of, it is the responsibility of the DME supplier to ensure that they're not over shipping or whatever, but there is a combination of policy edits, high volumes of data, and then the subscribe and save effect.
Right. And I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there, but it's like the edits, especially in a situation like this where they could have edits on the number of electrodes or batteries, much like other DME companies where they have edits on diabetic supplies and anything that's recurring, they can have an edit so you can only get a certain amount. And of course, the theory behind these like auto ships are, well, one, that the manufacturer, the supplier doesn't miss an opportunity to bill something because it's going there every month, but there's like discounts or rebates, whatever, for this, the higher volume. So it's, you know, you can get a lower cost per unit, but if it's in excess where the member is not using it and they're just stockpiling it in their closet, because as you say, if even if they're supposed to take use X amount of electrodes per month or the supplies, whatever, if they don't do that, a few extra every month just keeps adding up. And next thing you know, you have a closet full of, supplies. We were talking about it earlier. It's kind of like the Costco effect where, you can get a little bit better deal by buying in volume. But if you're not going to use it, and the Costco effect maybe is a little bit different because eventually you'll use all those paper towels, but the diabetic supplies, for example, or the electrodes, if you're getting an excess of 10 per month, and so there's 10 this month and 20, you have an excess of 100 of whatever, you're never going to get to use them because you're getting resupplied every month. It's same really with the prescription drug auto refill too. If you're supposed to take one, whatever it is, aspirin a day, and you take it most of the times, but you don't take it every single day, at the end of the month, you have excess, so you're not going into your next 30 days supply. Before you know it, I have a drawer with excess stuff that I don't take it as frequently as I should. That's another thing where, if the edits are correctly placed, you might be able to avoid some of that. But it's really, again, it's just that excess, not using them as often as you should. It may be just a few extra per month, but it adds up, and next thing you know, you have a closet full of extras.
One of the things that's in the regs in at least the state of New York for Medicaid is on those auto ships, they're not allowed to do that unless they contact the beneficiary first to make sure that the supplies are still needed.
Right.
And that's part of the edit system. Now, it's not enforced as it should. Right. Because it's on honor system, they just ship it, but they're vouching that they did contact the beneficiary.
Right. Well, and on the Medicare side, if we're on the, like, for example, with medication, there has to be an affirmative opt-in, as they call it, for auto ship, and it's only good for 1 year. And there were a couple of cases that are very similar, not with electrodes, but in the diabetic, in the insulin pen space, there were two cases that involved over dispensing, as we'll call it, of these pens, where the pens were coming in boxes of five. And I believe it was Walgreens that had the QI-TAM filed against them, where the argument was that they couldn't dispense less than five because they were all in a box and there was one package insert and the box was contained. And so if they had to do less, they were breaking up the packaging. And, could they do, could they not do it? And part of the argument the government made was you had a fiduciary responsibility to call the beneficiary to ask them at some point, do they have an oversupply or do they need more, and whatever it is. So, the auto ship feature is a good feature for people who are on a regular cadence where they would use actually what they're getting. I mean, if you're supposed to take one pill a day for something and you actually are on that regimen and you do it, the system should work properly and you should always get your medicine. But people don't always do what they're supposed to do. So the question then is, at what point does the responsibility shift, right? You would think the responsibility would be at some point with the patient, like, hey, I've got too much. But the problem is that we're dealing in the Medicare space, we're dealing with an elderly population of people. Maybe they don't even know who to call because they've never really had an issue with it. They get their stuff and they have a problem, but they don't know who to call. They're 85 years old and they're, maybe not fully with it, and so that becomes a piece. So that's why I think that the New York statute is pretty important, because it gives obviously the impetus for the onus to be on the supplier to do that. And of course the question is going to be, how do you then go and prove that you called the patient, right? So there's got to be some sort of paper trail on the supplier side. But it doesn't absolve them of that responsibility. So Matt, it gets to the next piece of this, which is in this case, in the Zinnix case, the chief operating officer and the CEO indicted. The company enters into what they call an NPA, non-prosecution agreement, to criminally resolve their issues and go on to some sort of corrective action plan. So there's a couple parts of this. First of all, the interesting thing is that they went after the company and they went after the principals, which, you know, we don't see that too often. So it's interesting to see that. But of course, you know, the question, Matt, that people will say is, well, if they were criminally looking to deal with this, why didn't the company, why is there an NPA? Why isn't there something else? And why, you know, so there's always that, why isn't there one more thing or one more thing? So talk a little bit about what are the effects of this, right? Remember, yeah, companies aren't people, so you can't put a company in jail.
Yeah, I've worked a lot of these types of corporate cases, large national chains of hospitals, things like that. So a part of it may be access to care. I don't know where these folks are located and where they distribute the TENS units to. It could be to rural areas, so they need them to operate. The other is the press release points out, you know, they filed for bankruptcy, but they're going to be paying $5 to $12.5 million back to the government in restitution based on their profits for the next year. So there's probably an ability to pay. If you exclude them from Medicare and Medicaid, that shuts them down and they're not going to be able to pay back the money that's owed. The other thing that they brought up was that there's been a change of ownership and they've turned the place around and they're on a corporate integrity agreement or whatever it may be. So they feel that the current company is law abiding and they're going to be paying the penalties for their predecessor company, which, you know, takes, you know, I take that with a grain of salt. I just think it comes down to the government wanted its money back and the only way to do it was to keep this company operating. You know, I've worked a lot of them where the corporation takes a plea, but it's not the corporation itself. It's a shell corporation that they exclude, which has no meaning whatsoever. And the company changes its name and goes on, whether it's, you know, whatever it might be. We've had a history of those types of things. And this is just another example of that. The good thing is there were two good things. One is they did go after the, you know, the bigwigs in the company, the high ranking officials, which is, I've seen somewhat rare. I've seen middle management. I've seen fingers pointed at the compliance officer or things. This is the first time they went after like a CEO and a COO, which is great. The other is you look at the laundry list of agencies that were involved in this. VA, DOD, FBI, HHS, Security and Exchange Commission. Yeah, so they pooled their resources here and they pooled, you know, they actually worked as a task force and got this place, you know, indicted and prosecuted. And that's something that needs to be done every time. You know, not only does it combine the damages, you really get the full extent of what the fraud is and how it affects both the government and the commercial sphere. So the approach to this case was more evolved than I've seen in the past.
So what about the argument that some people will make that will be, well, by keeping this company in the program, aren't they essentially paying us back our own money?
Yes, it's robbing Peter to pay Peter. Yes.
Right, right.
And there's no argument against that.
Right. And the thing that's interesting to me is the press release talks about over $600 million was considered fraudulent. There was something like $837 million or something like that.
Yep.
And and the argument is that $600 million of it is fraudulent, but the company is only paying
25 to 12 million. Yeah, 12 million. Yeah, says more than they forfeited claims, suspension of track. Yeah, it was $873 million, and they say $600 million of it was for probably the results of fraud, and they're paying back $12 million.
Right. Well, and I think there was a provision in there too. If they didn't meet all the conditions of the NPA, I think it was an immediate, wasn't it, $10 million fine they had to pay. If they, because there was like 70 pages of conditions they had to meet, and if they failed on any of them, it was like an instant $10 million, which is, considering that the actual amount was going to be $12 million, that's pretty hefty.
Well, great, they're on double secret probation now.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, and if you're only paying back $12.5 million, and you've got a $10 million fine that you're potentially getting. Okay, great. $22.5 million out of $600 million.
Yeah. You would hope maybe the SEC is going to take a shot at them as well, civilly. That's why they're involved, because it's a public corporation. They had to file their reports, you know, stating what their profits were. Probably if 80% right. of them were based on fraud, then there's some probably stock manipulation because of that. And they'll be paying fines on that over the top of the healthcare stuff.
Right, right. So wait, I want to go to you for the last word on this. This is one of those systems, you know, where one of these schemes where systems need to be in place to stop this excessiveness, right? So what are some of the things that plans should be thinking about doing to ensure that they're not getting whacked on these auto renewal type schemes?
Yeah, well, as we spoke about earlier, I think the amount of effort that goes into kind of tailoring and kind of tweaking the edits is well spent, because just having, you know, if it takes a bunch of, you know, agents, probably not agents, attorneys to work on these, you know, edits and different, you know, guardrails, basically, especially when you're looking at something like this, where you're talking $600 million, you know, if you had to have a team of attorneys working, you know, for a couple of months to get it right as far as the actual edits, I mean, it's well worth the juice is worth the squeeze in there, because of how much these edits can make a difference. And like, as you were saying, or Matt was saying, even the whole idea that they're supposed to certify that the member still need, you know, doesn't have an excess of whatever the equipment is or the supply is, when you're looking at these kind of numbers, it might be worth having, you know, a mechanism where someone actually forces them to call them, and you have to, you know, whatever the recording of this process, you know, maybe, I don't know, you could have 100 different ways to do this, but I mean, to take those extra steps to make sure that this doesn't happen, and that may be making ensuring that the members are spoken to, you know, every other month, every quarter or whatever, to make sure that they don't have, you know, in excess, and we can just say, okay, they have enough for another month, we're not sending anymore.
Yeah, it depends on what the supply is as well. If it's diapers and it's X number per month, and the company is billing at the max every month, no variation on it. It seeing a pattern of that in the data, it might be time to call the Bennies, and the Bennies might say, you know, they've got, you know, a closet full or whatever, and if that's a pattern, not only is that, you know, an instant problem with that provider, it's probably a problem with your edit allowing too many.
Right.
You know, so you can work it both ways that way. It's, you know, solve the instant problem, small problem of the supplier itself, and then what is the root cause of that being allowed? Is the edit is allowing too many?
Yeah, I think, you know, this case is not unique in any way, shape, or form. Other than the dollar amount is huge, and the fact that they got, you know, the facts of the case are not unique. It's the uniqueness is they got the company and the chief operating officer and the CEO, which does make it interesting. So I'll be interested to see if this was actually the result of a key TAM, if there was some proactive data analytics. Typically, they would have unsealed the key TAM by now on something like this after the indictment. So maybe there isn't, but we won't know. But it is an interesting case in that sense, and the dollar amount is pretty big. But the scheme is no different than a lot of these other DME auto refill type schemes out there. So interesting conversation to have with people. So thanks as always, guys. I appreciate you spending some time and enjoying this conversation. And we appreciate everybody for tuning in every week. And as always, you can get our newsletter every week in your inbox. Just send us info@advisehealth.com, or just sign up right from the splash screen on our main webpage. You can also get our weekly podcasts in on our YouTube channel and our Spotify channel. So just go to YouTube, hit the subscribe button. You'll get them every week sent right to you. And as always, we appreciate everybody spending the time, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.